Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
November 24th, 2014, Episode 69, Dr. Keith Delaplane, Part 1. Hello and welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. I'm Kevin England. This episode is the first of two special bonus editions featuring presentations from Dr. Keith Delaplane. Keith is a professor and an extension entomologist at the University of Georgia College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, and widely known for the book First Lessons in Beekeeping and the video series Honey Bees and Beekeeping, A Year in the Life of an Apiary. This presentation, which was sponsored by the New Jersey Beekeepers Association, was recorded October 18, 2014 at the Rutgers Eco Complex in Bordentown, New Jersey. In the session, Keith speaks about the hive as a superorganism and the dynamics that drive the interactions inside a colony. It might be noted that this presentation was extracted from a video that had accompanying slides, and may be lacking in visualizations that Keith refers to during the presentation. In general, the content will stand on its own, but if you wish to watch the presentation via video, it is available at www.youtube.com/NWNJBA. We would like to offer a special thanks to the NJBA for bringing Dr. Delaplane to New Jersey. Interested beekeepers can visit the NJBA website at www.njbeekeepers.org to see the calendar of future events and upcoming speakers as they become available. Also, acknowledgments to Dr. Delaplane for the insights and for allowing the ability to share the presentation. Please enjoy.
TV, and I don't think I've been here before. How did this happen? I'm glad we rectified that. I'm glad I'm here today. I think y'all have had my second in command, Jennifer Berry. Okay. How'd she do? Okay. Tough tracks to follow now, don't they? Well,
anyway, thank you. What I have for you today is a two-lecture series, and this is the more basic and preliminary of the two. The one that I will do after lunch, I think, is particularly practical for beekeepers, and as we try to decide how to deal with honeybee decline and the issues that we face today. So this, what I hope to deliver to you today, is both a big picture, but with a heck of a lot of practical take-home stuff for it. I think you will like it. It's such a big and broad, far-reaching subject, I've had trouble narrowing my title. Drivers Toward Colonial Life, The Superorganism and Why It Matters. Actually, I kind of like this one right here. Social Insects, Fact or Fiction. Is there really such a thing as a social insect? So this is the kind of stuff that we're going to be talking about all day long. If anything I say interests you, I encourage you to check out my website, University of Georgia. It has all of our publications on PDF there, a lot of our original research articles. Does that sound better? I felt like I was shouting in your ears. Is that better? Okay, thanks. But anyway, go there, just Google UGA, bees, something like that, and you'll find me. And there's a lot of stuff there. I do a lot of work in the UK, and I always have to clarify where exactly I'm from. The Georgia on this side of the world. Did you know Georgia's the biggest state east of the Mississippi? I didn't know that until just a few years ago. It's geographically, it's bigger than New York or Pennsylvania. Go check it out. Well, anyway, this is my state. The little A on the Google map is Athens. Athens-Clarke is the smallest county in the state. But it is also the home of REM and the B-52s. Yeah! Love Shack. All right, so this is where I come from. A cool, funky little town. This is my office. No, it really is. That building at the, like, 1 o'clock position, that's my building up there, the biological sciences building. And for years in Memorial, the entomology department was famous because we had free seats. And the faculty and graduate students would crowd up there and watch the game. Well, they figured this out after a while. And so today, the modern Stanford Stadium has that new row of president's boxes conveniently right across the south side of the stadium, so we can no longer mooch in on the games like we did. Well, now that we have established all these necessities, I'm going to kind of start talking about bees. And to begin, let's remind ourselves that the honeybee is not native to North America. It is, in fact, a newcomer. But not all newcomers are bad. You know, we get into the habit of thinking exotic alien invaders in negative terms, but the honeybee is one of those in a long list of introduced species that have naturalized themselves very well. We have the first record of them in North America in the 1600s, and within 200 years, there was debate among the naturalists of the young United States of America. There was debate whether, in fact, Apis mellifera was an exotic species, because by then, it had so thoroughly ensconced itself into the habitats of the eastern coast. But let's not forget that it is native to Europe, where they have castles. And this is my wife and me last spring in Ireland, visiting a very typical Irish little castle. And yes, up there, the hole in the middle of that big face was a colony of honeybees coming and going. So that has nothing to do with my talk. Right? It's just, I thought it was cool, so I wanted to show you that. This is, however, a part of my talk. And a beekeeper sent me this cartoon a few years... Don't worry, I'll read it to you here in a minute. I know it's hard to read. But a beekeeper sent me this cartoon a few years ago, and I have shamelessly used it ever since. If you are that beekeeper, identify yourself to me at this meeting so I can thank you, because I have pirated this ever since. What we have is a knight in shining armor at the top left, and he says, "My queen, I pledge my allegiance. How can I serve the kingdom?" Okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to stab our enemies using this tiny sword. I also want you to hook the sword into your internal organs. That way, when you stab someone, it rips out all your guts and you die. Your enemy won't die, of course, but it should sting a little, and maybe they won't bother us afterward. Does this sound like a good plan to you? I love that. I hope that each one of you have had a similar debate with yourself about this. You get what the cartoon is getting at. It's talking about the worker honeybee and how she sacrifices herself for the good of the colony. And surely this should make any one of us stop and pause, because this is a very strange behavior. It's altruism. It's not just altruism, it's the most extreme form of altruism that we can come up with, because what worker bees are essentially saying is, I am going to sacrifice my life for another. And not only am I going to sacrifice my life for another, I'm going to give up reproduction in order to help someone else reproduce. I mean, how ridiculous can it get more than that? Well, if you have ever puzzled about that at some level, you're not alone. You're in very good company, because Charles Darwin, the grand old man himself, in his world-changing tome of The Origin of Species, he wrestled with this incongruity, because he recognized that this was an aberration to his otherwise brilliant premise of natural selection. And just very quickly to recap, Darwin's genius was to recognize that species are plastic. They respond to selection pressures that nature gives them generation after generation after generation. And because some of those generations and some of those individuals will possess genes that are favorable, they tend to accumulate and pass those down to their progeny over time, so that over deep geological time, those favorable genes accumulate in the population. That's where we get survival of the fittest. The unfit genes sort of fall off the cliff and leave the population. So this is what Darwin recognized, that species are intimately molded by their environment. Evolution always, always, always operates hand in glove with the local environment. It's the local environment that shapes the species. That's the only difference between it and so-called artificial selection or human breeding. We too are selecting each generation for the genes that we like, but in our finite human lifespans, we don't have the luxury of deep time to correct for our mistakes. Nature does. If there's an excess of selection in one generation, then it'll be corrected for in a subsequent generation, so that over deep time, significant change happen to those species. So what about the honeybee that kills itself? Here we have an individual that is just not passing on any genes at all, but yet they're doing this. How could his theory account for this? Well, he died not knowing. Charles Darwin died before the modern science of genetics came on the scene, so he did not have the tools of genetics to even understand how things were inherited in the first place, let alone analyze them or synthesize them. So that question just sort of hung out there for over a century, unanswered, an enigma to biology. Well, let's take a look here and do a little background before we go any further. Here we have a family of honeybees. We have a mother and a father and the offspring. And just like all organisms, the genetic information for the honeybee is encoded in that most famous of all molecules, DNA. It looks like a ladder that is subsequently twisted up. And all along the string, we have molecules called nucleotides that are actual letters of an alphabet that code for proteins for everything. And they reside, most of them reside, in the nucleus of our cells. Now, most organisms, most normal organisms, like you and me, we have two sets of chromosomes. In the case of humans, we have 23 from our mother, 23 from our father. They come together in sexual reproduction, and we restore the number to 46. So humans have 46 chromosomes. You have 46 chromosomes. 23 from your mother, 23 from your father. And sex, I tell you, we just got to lay it out there. Sex is the greatest thing nature's ever come up with. Man. Hear, hear. Well, there's a reason for this. Sex is the best thing that nature has come up with for casting new dice every generation. Here's what sex is doing. It's like, we got a new generation here. Okay, roll this dice. Okay, nature, act upon that set of cards. It's a new set of gene combinations. And when your father's sperm and your mother's eggs come together and make you, that gene combination has never existed before. And you are a little blank slate for nature to act upon. Will you be selected for or against? Many of us have reproduced, so we can congratulate ourselves. We have been selected for. Well, this, there's two ways in which these new gene combinations can occur. Nature likes sex so much that it made not one but two ways for new gene combinations to come about. Now, before I depart this slide, let me just point out an anomaly about the honeybees and the entire order Hymenoptera, which includes the ants and the wasps and the bees. Their normal chromosome number is 32, 16 from the father, 16 from the mother. But in the case of the order Hymenoptera, the drones up there at the top right, they have only one set of chromosomes, period. They have only 16. And this is a hallmark across the entire order. Keep that in mind, because that's a pretty important nugget that we're going to come back to. Okay, new gene combinations. We've already talked about one, here's the second. When our germ cells are being made in our testes or ovaries, and this is true of all vertebrate organisms, there's a stage in that gamete formation when the chromosomes line up with one another. And then they cross legs. And those legs where they're crossed in the second diagram, they break off and exchange genetic material, take them back together, and they go back into the original chromosome, and then they separate again. That's called crossing over. And this is where new gene combinations occur in our bodies as our gametes are being formed. So you see how much nature loves new gene combinations. It goes to extraordinary lengths to make new ones every generation. This is why you are not a clone of your sibling. This is why you can honestly look at them and say, do we really share parents? Yeah, you do. That's how much genetic variation exists in your mother and your father, that you can come up with that person to be my brother. So nature is rich in available gene combinations and goes to great lengths to make new ones every generation for nature to act upon. Now we are ready to talk about Darwin's paradox, because it had to wait until 1964, more than a century later, before W.D. Hamilton, Bill Hamilton, a young postdoc at University College in London, and he wanted to sort of, this bothered him, you know, the anomaly about the social insects showing altruism. So he got out a piece of paper and a pencil, and he said, okay, let's just do the math. If it's all about passing my genes down to the next generation, well, let's just do the math and see exactly what's being passed down. And so he took an ordinary diploid animal. Okay. When I first gave this talk, I delivered it in London, so I made a hedgehog. It can just as easily be a guinea pig or something, but so I made this part here is for the British amongst us. But here we have a normal diploid animal, and by diploid I mean they have two sets of chromosomes, like you and me, not weird like the Hymenoptera. And we have a mother hedgehog and a father hedgehog, and they have a baby hedgehog. Well, that baby hedgehog got half of her genes from her mother, half from her father. And it makes sense, right? Well, what if that hedgehog has a sibling? Here's its sibling. How many genes in common will that hedgehog share with her sibling? Well, voila, it's 50%. Okay, not too surprising. But let's pause and look at the math, and I promise you it's 8th grade level. We can do this. Here's where that half comes from. This hedgehog and that hedgehog share half of their genes from their mother, but only half of her genes, because of that crossing over thing I told you about. Okay. Plus half from their father times only half of his genes because of crossing over. The 0.25 and 0.25 makes 0.5. They share, on average, 50% of their genes in common. They are, and the next sibling, it could be a whole different individual genes, but it would still be 50% of them. With me? Again, because they can be different. So he said, okay, that makes sense. Now let's do the same math for the honeybee. Here we have a mother and a father. We have a child honeybee down there at the bottom. She got half of her genes from her mother. She got half of her genes from her father. If she has a sibling, how much genes does she share in common with her sibling? And at about this moment, W.D. Hamilton's pulse rate started increasing a little bit. He said, okay, let's do the math here. Again, it's 8th grade math. These siblings share in common half their genes from their mother times half of her genes because of crossing over, plus half of their genes from their father, times all of his genes, because there is no crossing over with the haploid male. And by now he was positively shaking, and he ran out the sidewalks shouting, Eureka. 75% of genes are shared in common with their sisters. And he said, okay, now let's not get too excited. The honeybee worker can reproduce. Right? She can. If her pheromone, if the queen's pheromones are removed, the ovaries develop, she cannot mate, so there's nothing to restore the diploid number, so that haploid egg is going to become an individual, and it will be, of course, a drone. So here we have that worker who's decided to reproduce on her own. She produces a son. She has half of her genes in common with her son, compared to 75% of her genes in common with her super sister. Leading W.D. Hamilton concludes that a worker is more related to her super sisters than she is to her own sons, by which you can also conclude a worker can pass on more genes, helping mom produce more siblings than if she reproduces herself. And I sure hope he got tenure for this. Because in this one little paper, W.D. Hamilton gave birth to the entire science of kin selection, which has utterly dominated sociobiology ever since. Every generation of graduate students since him has done a lot of work on this, filling in the gaps. And basically it boils down to, if we can trace the currency of genes, where's the gene flow going between generations? And if we can find and show strategies that maximize the number of my genes getting passed downstream, then we can find evolutionary explanations, evolutionary justifications for why this would happen. It took over a century for Darwin's theory to be substantiated, even in the case of the anomalous social bees who practice altruism. Yes, I'll practice altruism if it means that my mother has a better chance of producing my super sibs who are 75% related to me. You bet, sign me up. It makes fantastic evolutionary sense. Well, this is great, and we cannot minimize the contribution of W.D. Hamilton. He's been absolutely devastatingly huge to the whole science of sociobiology. But it took honeybee scientists about 3 minutes to realize, wait a minute, hang on a second here. I think there must be more going on here than just Bud Hamilton's handy little kin selection theory. Because what we see in the modern honeybee is not really that neat little monogamous family that W.D. Hamilton described. It's messier than that. What does the honeybee queen do? Well, she mates with many males in that cloud there on the left of a drone congregation area. She goes out and she finds, on average, about 15 of them. And she can store that sperm in her spermatheca and sire her offspring for the rest of her life off of that mixture, so that her colony on the right is a complicated mixture of many patrilines, any members of which are only 25% related with one another. So it appears that W.D. Hamilton is really, really good at describing how social evolution may begin, but he is not the end of the game. And so social evolution has matured an awful lot in the decades since W.D. Hamilton, and we now understand it to be more complicated than just kinship. I want to talk to you about what are the things that make an insect decide to live colonially. Well, we've already talked about one of them, kin selection. You know that already. And in fact, a paper just came out in 2008 out of England that did a phylogenetic analysis on the order Hymenoptera and showed that monogamy is in fact the ancestral state. This is the most primitive state of social evolution in the bees and the wasps. So we can sort of now start describing the proto-honeybee. Imagine with me now for the next few minutes the proto-honeybee, the earliest honeybee, and how did she go through her natural selection in history to result in the bee that we know today? It started out with kin selection, a simple monogamous pairing which created a nice little neat colony in which all of the inmates were 75% related to one another and exercised extreme altruism. But then over geologic time, other things begin to attach to that species, all of which support staying together. Let's talk about some of them. Group selection is one of those factors. We now have this little proto-honeybee. She mated monogamously. She has her little cohort of workers that are super sisters. And there is another force that begins to come into play. And it's kind of best described Let's just all get along, okay? Who was it? Rodney King, was it, in Los Angeles? Let's all get along. Well, he's on to something there. More times than not, if a group decides to cohere and coordinate and cooperate, the survivorship of all of the members tends to go up. So, okay, there's another reason to be social that attaches to kin selection, okay? Fine. Well, what's another force that acts on that proto-honeybee? Chaos avoidance. What does chaos look like if you're in a group? Well, here's one way it could look like. You are a early honeybee, and you lose your queen. So here's what could happen. I want my super sister to be the next queen. Okay, so I'm going to go over here, I'm going to guard her, I'm going to feed her royal jelly, my super sister. Okay, well, someone else is over here, I want my super sister to be queen. And she guards this larva and feeds it royal jelly. So you've got these competing camps going on around here, right? Well, the funny thing is, that does not happen. For the most part, such nepotism, and that's what we're talking about here, has not been rewarded in social evolution. Have you ever wondered why you can go out to your apiary and you find a queenless colony? Oh, darn. You get on your phone, you call Fred Rossman or someone down in Georgia, right? And Fred, send me a queen. Fred sends you a queen, you get it, you go out there, you stick in your hive, and they accept it. Why should they accept that queen from Fred Rossman? It's an utter alien. It has nothing in, no relatedness whatsoever, right? Or you go over and get a frame of brood, have another colony, stick it in there. Why do they raise a queen out of it? Why do they even feed it, let alone make a queen out of it? You ever wondered about that? It's because nepotism is just not a big deal with honeybees, the genus Apis, in the interest of avoiding chaos to keep the group together. Queen coercion. Now that our honeybee is sort of at an intermediate stage of social evolution, we start seeing now another force come into play. The queen says, you know what? I kind of like this being a queen thing. They feed me. They do everything I need. I don't have to fly. I don't have to work. I just crank out the eggs and the pheromones. Sign me up. I like this. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep you in your place so that I can stay in my place. And if you're a bumblebee, what you do, you go up to one of your daughters, and you grab them, and you shake them. And for reasons I don't understand, that makes the daughter's ovaries contract and suppress. I don't know why it does. So the honeybee, of course, is far more sophisticated than that, and she uses pheromones, right, to keep the worker's ovaries in a low state. But the result is the same. We now have queen coercion. The queen is becoming an active player, and we start seeing kind of a social stratification beginning to galvanize and get stronger in this little proto-honeybee nest. Okay, near and dear to my heart, this is the subject of my second lecture, but polyandry begins to come into play. And polyandry, if you know your Greek, means many males. And what we have here is a case of the honeybee queen saying, I got my nice little family here, this group that is getting more and more socially stratified and coherent. How can I give this little family of mine its maximum genetic assets to deal with all of the vagaries that nature throws at it? Well, there's a couple ways you can do this. If you are an ant or a termite, you can have little fiefdoms pop up on the edge of your empire. And what you have is, off the edge of the nest, you'll have a little daughter who decides she kind of wants to be a queen, and she mates and starts rearing their own little brood off to the side. And another daughter, I say off to the side because it has to be sort of away from the pheromonal suppression of the original queen in the center. And so you get this budding that occur. And that's why the ants and the termites are so much more socially complex than the ants, because they don't have the strictures of a confined nest. The world is the limit if you are a termite or an ant, because there's no boundaries to the edge of your subterranean nest, as opposed to a hollow tree if you're a member of the genus Apis. spatially, you're far more constrained. So if you are a member of the genus Apis, you can't have all this hanky-panky going around because the house is so much smaller. What are you going to do instead? You'll practice polyandry. You'll fly out. The resident queen, will mate with many males. She'll have an organ called the spermatheca that stores that sperm, and thereafter, her workers are the product of mixed paternity with more genetic variation. This is really, really, really important. Okay? This is huge to the evolution of the honeybee, the entire genus Apis, and I think it's really big for beekeepers in New Jersey in 2014. Okay? So big, in fact, I'm going to talk about it in my next lecture. Well, then, right, termites. Finally, we get to this part, the terminally fixed queen cast. Okay, it looks like this. The queen has now gone through so much geologic history and specialization, coercion. She has been affected by natural forces selecting on her for generations after generations, to the point that she no longer can do the functions of a worker. She cannot forage, even if she wanted to. Likewise, the workers cannot do queen-like behaviors anymore. The two have become reproductively dependent on the other. And in Darwinian terms, what is an entity? What is a biologically viable unit of selection? It's an individual that is reproductively competent. If you can't play the game, if you can't reproduce, you're not even in the game. So at this level, with the so-called point of no return, I'm sorry. Is there a song going through your head? The point of no return? We're betraying our age together here in Kansas, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, once we've passed that point of no return, you can no longer think of the worker as an entity, or the queen as an entity. And suddenly, like a picture slowly coming into focus, it suddenly comes into focus, the nest is now Darwin's unit of selection. And suddenly, the entire concept of a social insect falls off the cliff. You see what's happened? The unit of selection now becomes the colony. And its members are more akin to the cells in an organism. The workers are the cells of the body. Their different functions are analogous to different organs of the body. What is the uterus of the superorganism? It's the new made combs. And it is new. In natural field colonies, they will rear new combs out of that season's nectar and preferentially put their brood in these combs, and they relegate last year's brood combs to honey storage. This is what they do if they're unmanaged. That's your uterus. What's the liver? Well, the liver is last year's combs, because that oil-soluble wax can suck up the toxins that nature has out there and just sort of hold it in abeyance against the water-soluble larvae in the honey. What are the ovaries? They are the queen. What are the sperm? What are the drones? They are the drones. We're going to talk about what the brain is here in a minute, because that's the most exciting part of all. If this stuff interests you in the least, there's a couple books I recommend, especially the one on the right. Jürgen Taut's The Buzz About Bees, which I think is a stupid title. But the subtitle nails it, The Biology of a Superorganism. You ought to get it just for the pictures. The pictures are just fantastic. The one on the left is by the grand old man in our lifetime, E.O. Wilson, a good Alabama boy who studied ants and made it big. He now writes about far bigger things than ants. But before we leave E.O. Wilson, I want to go back a little bit in history. He's been around a long time. He's in his mid-80s and he's still very active. Back in 1971, he published a book that I grew up on as a graduate student, The Insect Societies, E.O. Wilson, widely cited still to this day. But in those intervening years, we now see that he too has changed his lexicon to the superorganism. So this is pretty new stuff that we're talking about. This is a new, it's not a theory. We can't really call it a theory yet, but it is a new conversation going on in social evolution that simply posits the colony as a unit of selection rather than the individuals that make it up. Thereby, the entire idea of a society just sort of becomes obsolete, because a society is a unit of individuals. In Darwinian terms, you're not really an individual unless you're reproductively competent. Now, this pathway that I have painted for you should not be so monstrous as you might originally think. Let's do a thought experiment together. I propose to you that we are a society of sorts right here today in this room. And I would predict that a few of you out there are a member of this society for purely kinship reasons. And it kind of goes like this. You want to keep what in our backyard? I've been reading about it. I saw this cool video about pollinators and bees, and I thought it'd be kind of fun to have a beehive in the backyard. Oh, you insist. All right, okay. We'll try it, we'll do it. And besides, there's this cool group that meets and they do a workshop on beekeeping. Okay, I'll go. I'm touching a note there, anybody? So you go to that first meeting, right? And you go there and, it wasn't that bad. You know, the speaker was okay, the refreshments were all right, the lunch was good, friendly, yeah, they're okay. Okay, we can go again. And a year later, you're the treasurer. So you see what happened, though. Kinship was what started it. But as you continue in the group, other reasons begin attaching to it. You kind of enjoy it. You enjoy the company. You get fulfillment out of it. You can put your skills to good use. It's just kind of the same reason why we keep our jobs. You know, originally it was a paycheck. But then, you know, most of us, I hope, we kind of like our jobs for other reasons, too. You know, it gives us a sense of fulfillment or whatever. So this is not outrageous thinking. It's just being translated into geologic time. And you realize that these highly colonial species are the way they are from a whole geologic history of natural forces that act upon them to get them to where they are today. Well, what does this mean for you? What does this mean for us as beekeepers? I propose to you that thinking of the honeybee as a superorganism helps you be a better beekeeper, and it helps you just understand what you see year in and year out, day after day. We've already talked about one of them, why we can replace queens with aliens. You know, well, it also explains why do they overwinter instead of hibernating? Why do they swarm when they do? Well, think about it. The superorganism has biomass. It's comparable to a dog, for crying out loud. It's not a box of bugs, all right? So you get this entity that is a vegetarian wasp, and initially that's what honeybees are. All bees, their primal state was a carnivore wasp. Wasps are primitive to the bees. And at some point, about the evolution of the angiosperms, the flowering plants, we had these wasps that specialized upon this new food resource that nature had just provided it, and they started getting their pollen, their protein off the pollen, like the video so elegantly said. And the plants started producing nectar to encourage more of this kind of thing. And so we had this coevolution. So this vegetarian wasp started collecting nectar and started having all these social forces acting upon it that made it cohere into a superorganism. 12 months out of the year, it lived in northern Europe where it was cold. It exploited the niche available to it for nest sites, which is hollow trees. And because it's a big, long winter that it has to endure, it has to store a lot of that nectar. Oh gosh, this nectar is going to spoil. What are we going to do with it? Let's dehydrate it so that it doesn't spoil. And voila, you know, we have the honeybee. So you see how this stuff is not just ancillary. It is so central to what we do that we can't even see it. Okay? It is what the honeybee is and how it got there. So here we have this colonial superorganism, and it's going to hibernate because the queen has passed the point of no return. They cannot cheat like the bumblebees do. The bumblebees cheat. Bumblebees are not as far along this scale, okay? They're still sort of lagging way back. They're still trying to make up their mind about that point of no return thing. Because you can have very queen-like workers, and you can have very worker-like queens in Bumblebee. They've not passed that point yet. So what they do is cheat. It gets to be the end of winter, and here's what bumblebees say. They call a Congress together, and they all come together and say, okay, winter's about here. How are we going to do this? And they say, okay, let's all die. Okay, I'm going to die, you die, the old queen dies. Males die. The only ones who make it over are the newly fertilized daughters. Cheerio. Godspeed to you. Well, honeybees don't do that, okay? They've passed that point of no returns. They've still got winter, so they're going to have to hibernate. And so they survive winters that would kill you or me without protective clothing. They are as homeothermic as we are when you look at them at the level of a superorganism. As an individual, you get a cold blood, they die within seconds. But as a coherent superorganism, they control their inner core temperature. The young bees love to cluster in the middle because they're young, and young bees like to cluster in the middle and stay warm. That was a tautology, wasn't it? I went around in a circle, but I'm doing that on purpose. The older bees don't like to be so hot, so they sort of hang on the outside. Okay, well, you got the cluster, okay? And it's not from some hierarchical order imposed from the top down. It's lateral order. I like to be warm. I like to be a little bit cooler. And so they just self-stratify where they want to be. They generate heat by shivering because they're cold. You know, so they generate heat. Here they are in the middle shivering. It can get too hot. And so the older ones on the outside sort of back, what do you do when you get hot and you're in a crowded room? You crunch up closer? No, you back up. And so this is not some hierarchical design imposed upon them, okay? It's the action of little individual actors doing their own thing, leveling up, spacing out, and hence you get social coherent thermoregulation. When does brood rearing begin? Brood rearing begins when resources start coming in. It's a nice 95 degrees Fahrenheit right in the middle, because that's the heat that they generate when they're in the middle, all clustered up together. You see how cause and effect gets plastic here and flips around? You know, they don't get into a winter core to make it 95 so the brood can be produced. Brood is produced when it's 95 because that's the temperature it is when they cluster together. That's how evolution works. It's so simple sometimes that it's too simple for us to grasp and hang on to. And they're very good at it. They're very good at maintaining this kind of hibernation. Why do they invest so heavily in swarms? Well, again, keep in mind what our superorganism is. It's a vegetarian wasp from Northern Europe. And all of its income comes in relatively brief period of weeks, just a few, 4 or 5 maybe, out of a 52-week year. So for that brief time, they have to be really, really good at collecting their income. I think of it as a college student. You got summer to earn your money for the rest of the year, right? Well, that's when you got to make your income. So you got to do this early so that you will split. You'll split your body. Okay, this is how the superorganism reproduces. I'm just going to split my body. Here, take half of my body cells. Take some of the food, too. Take some of the fat off of my body. Take all this you got stored. Here, take my ovaries. They're proven. You don't have new combs to build your new ovaries on. You can't rear a queen, so take mine. That's what we call costly reproduction. Now, there are two types of organisms in ecology, so-called K-selected and the R-selected. And the K-selected invest very heavily in their offspring and can only make a few of them. Elephants are K-selected. We are K-selected, especially if you had a kid in college. children can be very expensive. The opposite of that is R selected, and think of a loggerhead turtle. Babies, babies, lots of babies, cheap babies, gonna make tons of them. Cheerio, good luck. Hope you avoid the sharks. Well, this is K-selected behavior. This is not just a bunch of bugs, you know, that just die. This is a superorganism investing heavily in very few offspring. This is why swarming is such a disaster if you're a beekeeper. The superorganism has cut its body in two, and it's done it right early in the season, right when it's got the maximum amount of nectar coming in, so that it has time to recover from this body split, and the offspring has time to recover and build a comb and build their uterus and their ovaries and their livers and their fat body, so that they can survive the next winter. It's what we eat and breathe in beekeeping, and this is where it comes from. Why do new swarms establish about 500 meters away from the parent? They do. The average density of this superorganism is about 1 per square kilometer. Because K-selected superorganisms make big demands on their habitats. You can't have so many elephants in the neighborhood. So they space themselves apart. Along comes beekeeper Bob. And you see these horrific holding yards in California almond, like I'm showing up there in the middle. And how does that cohere with the natural density of the superorganism that wants to be just a kilometer apart from its nearest neighbor? Does this have anything to say about disease transmission and pathogen virulence, do you think? Why would it forage so efficiently? Because, as I alluded earlier, the superorganism has only a few weeks to get all of its income. And this is where we get to Tom Seeley's brilliant contributions to this conversation. I didn't ask you earlier, what is the brain of the superorganism? Because I was waiting for this. This is the brain of the superorganism. And it's best described in how they make group foraging decisions. The superorganism is constantly sticking its fingers out there in the habitat and sampling. And within minutes, it can muster its foraging force to the few richest resources that are out there. And while they're over there just tearing apart that sourwood tree, and I mentioned sourwood because that's Georgia especially, we're over there with sourwood. Well, there's little scouts that are over here checking out this sourwood tree. And what do? They come back and they do the famous recruitment dance, which is symbolic language. They come back and they say, okay, here's what we're going to do. Let's all pretend that the sun is at that angle out our front door, and the resource that I found is that angle outside my front door. We're all going to pretend that the top of the comb is aiming straight at the sun. The angle at which I do my dance indicates the angle left or right from the sun relative to our nest entrance. Go in that direction and you'll find the resource that I'm dancing for. And so the recruits, and these are the ones who read the dances, they come up and check it out. Yeah, okay, that sounds good. But I'm going to check out this dance. We come over here. Ooh, yeah, this dance is faster, which means it's a better resource. Here, have a taste sample. Ooh, yeah, like that. I'm going to go on this flight path. So she goes out there. Now, there's a couple things that can happen when that recruit goes out. She could show up, and there's no one else there. Have you ever been the first to show up for a party? What is there about that? It's so uncomfortable. But if you get there and the lights are all on, loud noise, come on in, come on, you know, and right back in. Well, it's the same way as the bees. They go out there, hey, where's everyone else? Then they go back to the nest. Or if they go out there and everyone else is there, then they go back and they do a dance, which has an additive effect. So within minutes, seconds, I would dare say, in some cases, the foraging force can just be diverted from there to there. How was this decision made? Was it hierarchical? No. It was just individual actors doing what individual actors do, which has the additive effect of stimulating the other actors to participate in the same behavior, such that the group arrives at the optimum decision. Does this have anything to say for artificial intelligence, systems engineering, product flow, was reading a paper not too long ago that and maybe some FedEx or UPS people here in the room, but they're using algorithms like this from social insects to calculate optimum delivery paths. So yes, this is how the superorganism thinks. This is how the decisions are made. This is its brain. Why do workers accept foreign queens? You know the answer. Why do workers rear queens from foreign larvae? You know the answer to that too. Why put brood in the newest combs like they do? So they don't want to rear brood in the colony's liver. They would rather rear their brood in its uterus. Weird, I know, but it helps put things into focus and perspective. Does this have anything to say about diseases and health and parasites? You know it does. But that is such a juicy, important topic that it has to wait until after lunch. Yeah. So let's recap. We have sort of painted a path that leads us to the modern honeybee that we all know and love today. How did that journey begin? It began with a wasp that was a carnivore that exploited this new resource that nature had just given it, the flowering plants, for its source of protein. The plants, in turn, responded by secreting nectar to attract more pollinators. Our particular vegetarian wasp radiated and adapted from Northern Europe. At some point, because in its history, the male Hymenoptera just lost a set of chromosomes. You know, things like that happen in evolution. They just lost it. I lost it and I can't find it. They lost it. So what did nature do with this? Well, it exploited it. And it makes the possibility of these hyper-related individuals living together. Why live together? Because I can pass down more of my genes if I help mom reproduce. Well, that's fine. That's what got it kick-started. But there are other drivers that build upon Hamilton's kin selection theory. Things like group selection, queen coercion, avoiding chaos, polyandry, the point of no return. And once we get to that point of no return, it is no longer even plausible to think about the individuals in that nest as individuals anymore. And the whole idea of a society that we have loved our entire human history, the feminine monarchy, for crying out loud, and all these wonderful tones that we love so much, and the poetry that's been written is basically just dashed in favor of a new emerging concept of the colony as a superorganism. It is the entity upon which nature acts. It is the entity that is fit or not fit, that survives or not. It is the entity that acts upon the environment around it, including the crops that it pollinates. I would suggest to you that thinking about honeybees as superorganisms instead of individuals in a society, it makes us rethink high colony densities. This K-selected superorganism is a big animal that makes big demands on its habitat. It should not be crammed into 25 of these animals in a space the size of this room. It encourages us to cull out old combs. We know from Jennifer's thesis research that old combs reduce brood production. Gosh, gee, what a surprise. We're forcing the bees to rear brood in their livers. No wonder the brood production is not so good. How often should we cull them out? I would offer to you every 5 years. And why 5 years? Because Tom Seeley has shown us that the superorganism lives on average about 5 years before it cashes in and dies. They are mortal. They are not immortal. Because it's a superorganism with high biomass, it encourages us to feed them like they are. It's a dog. It's a biomass of a dog, at least, a big dog. How much does your dog eat in a year? Well, this superorganism needs the same amount of protein and calories. Hopefully, nature is providing most of it, but if it doesn't, you need to step up and make sure that superorganism has enough food. And as a teaser for this afternoon, I would suggest to you that superorganism theory helps us rethink the way we breed bees, emphasizing high drone densities, multiple mated queens, and high colony genetic variation. But more for that to come. I will stop. Maybe I'm within my time frame, and maybe you have a question. He says, wrap it up. Oh, well, I have nothing more to say.